You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ronald Reagan is often credited with bringing about the end of the Cold War, but how pivotal was his role and how did it evolve over his two terms in office? In his latest book, James Mann, who's currently author in residence at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, looks at President Reagan as a leader and at his complicated and competitive relationship with Mikhail Gorbachev. The Rebellion of Ronald Reagan, A History of the Cold War, is published by Viking, and I'm pleased that it brings James Mann back to the show today. Hello.
Good to be with you.
We're talking about Ronald Reagan, but how much of a role did Richard Nixon play in shaping foreign policy during the early years of the Reagan presidency?
Nixon maintained his own private relationship with Reagan. He saw himself as an advisor. This is in the period when, of course, he's left the White House. He's resigned because of Watergate. He's out in disgrace. People now remember or have seen the Frost-Nixon movie. He becomes, oddly enough, a hawkish advisor to Ronald Reagan in Reagan's second term. Nixon is advising him that Gorbachev is just another in a long line of Soviet leaders, not fundamentally different from others.
Was Henry Kissinger saying the same thing? Because Henry Kissinger had been frozen out of Reagan's councils, hadn't he?
In fact, during this period, from 85 to 88, it brought Nixon and Kissinger together against Reagan. They both interpreted Gorbachev in his first years as trying to reassert Soviet power, that the purpose of Gorbachev's reforms was to make the Soviet Union stronger and more active overseas.
Well, when I think back at the two leaders that Richard Nixon is most associated with, Mao,
right,
and in this case Gorbachev, Chairman Mao seems to me to be the much worse, much more scary guy. Did something change in Richard Nixon, the man who went to China and changed our policy in regard to one of the worst dictatorships that ever was?
My own interpretation of Nixon is that he was looking for a role for himself. When Reagan first came to office, Nixon was going back and forth between the Soviets, the Soviet ambassador in Washington, Dobrynin, and the Reagan administration, trying to be an intermediary. But as Reagan and his Secretary of State, George Shultz, develop a relationship with Gorbachev, Nixon looks for a new role for himself, and it's to be as the upholder of the old Cold War order.
And was Reagan paying attention to what he had to say?
He was paying attention, but he didn't go along. There's a I found in doing the book a memo Nixon wrote to himself in 1987 of a secret meeting at the White House. Nixon had never been there inside the White House since the day he left in 74. He gets brought upstairs. Reagan sits down and talks to him, looks for Nixon's support for his diplomacy with Gorbachev, and Nixon won't give it. Reagan wants to proceed with a particular kind of arms control agreement. Nixon won't go along.
And arms control is a big issue here. Reagan really stepped up the anti-nuclear aspects of his foreign policy. But how different was his approach to Jimmy Carter's stated aim to end the arms race, which had been ridiculed by conservatives?
Not that different. What was different was Reagan politically. Reagan was able in 1988 to get an arms control treaty approved by the Senate. He got over 90 votes because he had conservative support. Carter, by contrast, failed to get any arms control through the Senate because he didn't have conservative support.
The same sort of thing as Nixon opening up China.
Absolutely.
Rather than a Democrat opening up China. Nixon met Gorbachev in 1986. What was his impression of the Soviet leader?
Well, I, in the book, facetiously talk about the metallurgy of the Cold War because often American leaders or columnists who wrote about the Soviet Union fall into talking about iron, iron, steel, flinty eyes, and Nixon fell right into that pattern. He started to compare Gorbachev to others he had known. He said that Gorbachev uses a stiletto, but inside his velvet glove there's a steel fist. And again, it's this interpretation early on that Gorbachev really was going to become another Brezhnev or another just another Soviet leader.
And not all that different from any number of other people in government at the time, including Robert Gates.
That's right. The leading proponent inside the Reagan administration of this view that the Soviet Union wasn't changing was the CIA's leading expert on the Soviet Union, a guy named Robert Gates, the current Secretary of Defense. And really, what Nixon and Kissinger were saying outside, what columnists like Charles Krauthammer and George Will were writing, was what Robert Gates was saying inside the government.
And there, any number of other people, and they were all wrong, weren't they?
They were wrong. It was a tremendous misperception of Gorbachev. They didn't begin to recognize it. Some people maintained this view well into the early years of the Bush administration after Reagan had left office. I'm thinking of Dick Cheney. The first recognition that really Gorbachev was something different was near the very end of Reagan's presidency. Gorbachev comes to the United Nations and he announces that he's going to cut Soviet troop strength by 500,000 and withdraw divisions from Eastern Europe.
It's interesting with Ronald Reagan now being the role model for conservatives to look back and see that Howard Phillips of the Conservative Caucus called Reagan a useful idiot for Soviet propaganda.
There is a good part of the book is about the attacks by conservatives on Ronald Reagan. These really began in about 85 or 6. George Will, I think, wrote that he had used to think that Reagan was a keeper of the Cold War flame, but time flies.
My guest is James Mann, whose latest book is The Rebellion of Ronald Reagan, A History of the End of Cold War, published by Viking. Are we talking about that rebellion?
Reagan is rebelling against his conservative supporters and against the foreign policy establishment.
So how has his image as a conservative been held up as strongly as it is? Have we misread Reagan all along?
Well, this was a reasonable reading of Reagan in his early years in office, for sure. And then you go through this period in Reagan's second term where the conservatives are furious at him. After the Cold War ends, or after the Berlin Wall comes down in 1989, President George Bush Sr. says very little. People begin to pull out the old clips of Reagan saying to Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Well, let's play one of those clips because this deals with another aspect. He saw the Cold War, Reagan did, as not just a foreign policy struggle, but as a moral struggle. And I'm not sure whether anyone else had posited it in the way that he had.
So in your discussions of the nuclear freeze proposals, I urge you to beware the temptation of pride, the temptation of blithely declaring yourselves above it all and label both sides equally at fault. To ignore the facts of history and the aggressive impulses of an evil empire, to simply call the arms race a giant misunderstanding, and thereby remove yourself from the struggle between right and wrong and good and evil.
The famous evil empire statement. Who was he addressing in that speech?
He was talking in Florida to the National Association of Evangelicals. It was meant very much for an audience of evangelicals.
Did he soften his stand after he met Gorbachev? Is that what changed him?
Absolutely. He goes to, at the end of his term in the summer of 88, he goes to Moscow and gets specifically asked, is this an evil empire? Do you still think this is an evil empire? And he says that was another time, another era. And he gets asked again, why is that? And he really credits Gorbachev.
What were the circumstances of their first meeting?
They first met at a summit in 1985 in Geneva. It was meant to be on, you know, neither Allied territory nor one's home turf.
How long after Gorbachev had come to power?
About six, 7 months after. Mm-hmm. And they agree to meet a couple more times, but then they keep putting it off. They keep putting it off until they have really the most momentous of their summits, which is in Iceland in 1986.
Didn't Reagan's aides urge him not to wear a coat at that first meeting?
That's right. There's a very famous photograph that Reagan got a lot of credit for that shows Gorbachev coming out all bundled up, big hat, and Reagan has no coat at all. The truth is, as I found in writing the book, Reagan wanted to wear a coat, and one of his own aides said, put it off, and he took the coat and threw it at him and said, all right, damn it, have it your way.
So foreign policy is, to some degree, based on posturing?
It is. It certainly, you know, that includes the Reagan White House. The speech in Berlin in 1987, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, was defended in part as this is a soundbite that everybody is going to remember.
Uh-huh. So it's like JFK saying, ich bin ein Berliner, or something like that. But I get the impression that Gorbachev thought he was the smartest person in the room when he met Reagan.
Gorbachev prided himself as a debater. He was very good on policy. And so I talked to one of the note takers when Reagan and Gorbachev met one-on-one without the presence of their Secretary of State or Foreign Minister. There were always note takers in the room. And one of them described to me how Gorbachev would start to make points to Reagan, would be satisfied that he'd really, that what he'd said was brilliant, and he'd look around the room looking for an audience, and the note takers would kind of turn their eyes down because they're supposed to be not there. And Gorbachev would realize he was in the room with a guy who was really telling stories and anecdotes and wasn't going to engage the way Gorbachev wanted to.
Was that cleverness on Reagan's part, or was that a certain lack of ability to connect on an important issue?
That was Reagan's style. People would come in, sit down with him, and he would start telling jokes. If it was either a Soviet or Eastern European leader, he would start telling anti-communist jokes. So, you know, people would come in to want to talk about arms control, and he'd say, what are the four problems with Soviet agriculture? And the person would look stumped, and he'd say, spring, summer, fall, or winter.
And Hillary Clinton is being criticized for having a badly translated button?
In my mind, it was his way of deflecting controversy and getting what he wanted without engaging.
Uh-huh. Well, then came Reykjavik. Right. And I remember Reykjavik and the panic in conservative circles. They felt that he was ready to give away the store.
He and Gorbachev had spoke, actually, about either dramatically cutting back on missiles and or abolishing nuclear weapons. They didn't reach a deal. This all got held up by disagreements over Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative. But it was the first time that both countries had begun to talk about dramatic reductions. And when Reagan came home, he actually began pushing the foreign policy agencies, particularly the Pentagon, to see what they could do about this. And they, to say the least, pushed back. They didn't like it at all. And from then on, I had one guy say for the rest of his term, Reagan was really sort of kept under watch because they thought he was being snookered by Gorbachev.
And he was not just criticized by Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, but also by Margaret Thatcher, Helmut Kohl, some other conservative European leaders.
Right. And one of Reagan's diplomatic accomplishments was he would get on the phone with Helmut Kohl and kind of bring him along. And Thatcher went along on her own, finally.
If they didn't go along with this kind of negotiation and open discussion about disarmament, what foreign policy track did they want Reagan to pursue?
Well, they were very nervous about the idea of taking intermediate range missiles out of Europe. They were afraid that would leave them vulnerable to a Soviet conventional attack. It was really an argument over military strategy.
My guest is James Mann, who is the author of the New York Times bestseller Rise of the Vulcans, also China Fantasy, among others. These days, he's author in residence at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, but was for many years foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. His book, The Rebellion of Ronald Reagan, The History of the End of the Cold War, is published by Viking, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with James Mann. His latest book, The Rebellion of Ronald Reagan, A History of the End of the Cold War, it's published by Viking. You call the 1986 summit one of the most tumultuous summits in the entire Cold War. Now, what was the ultimate result? Did it really change American policy, or was it just simply Ronald Reagan offering to change American policy?
The immediate result was nothing. They didn't reach an agreement. Reagan was actually frustrated and angry that he couldn't get, and actually seemed to have some second thoughts about whether he could have gotten an agreement.
Was Gorbachev the one who was causing the problems, or was it Reagan getting the rest of the Americans to go along with him?
No, it was between Reagan and Gorbachev. It was based on Reagan's insistence that he wasn't going to do away with the Strategic Defense Initiative. But he seemed to worry that maybe he should have. And there's always a historical question of, you know, what if he'd said yes, or what if Gorbachev hadn't been so obsessed with what we call Star Wars? So the summit ends. There's no result. But really now the United States has begun to see what the Soviet Union might be willing to do, and vice versa. And by about 4 months later, Reagan and Gorbachev agree on the outlines of a treaty to ban intermediate-range missiles from Europe. And that's really the beginning of sort of the summitry of the last 2 years.
And Richard Nixon had been highly critical of what had gone on in Reykjavik, and yet in 1987, Reagan met with him for help with diplomatic efforts with Gorbachev. Why?
At that time, Nixon and Kissinger had co-written an op-ed in the Washington Post criticizing Reagan's ideas, and Reagan was trying to bring him along, trying to get his support. So he gives Nixon this rare, unprecedented treat of coming back to the White House. Nixon comes up. He looks at the places where he used to work. He looks around. I have this through Nixon's own memo, which had never been published before. He wrote a memo to himself after the meeting, looking around at how Reagan and Nancy Reagan had redecorated the place, how much money they'd spent. Because this is vintage Nixon, full of resentments. He starts telling stories about meeting Lyndon Johnson upstairs in the White House. But one way or another, Reagan's looking for this help on arms control, and Nixon says no.
One important advisor to Reagan was a woman named Suzanne Massey. Who was she?
Very unusual woman. She was an author. She was not a specialist in any kind of foreign policy. She had written, along with her husband, the book Nicholas and Alexandra, the one that became a movie. And she was brought in to Reagan in 1984, really to give him a feel for life in the Soviet Union. And although the meeting was, you know, probably 10 people, Reagan somehow liked her. And he invited her back again and again and again. And she served a couple purposes for Reagan. For one thing, she provided the anecdotes that Reagan craved. She gave him slogans. The famous one, trust but verify, was one that she brought to him. Reagan really didn't like abstract intelligence reports. He liked to get a feel for life in the Soviet Union.
Was he looking to her for some insight into the way Russians think?
Yeah, and I think she gave him something he needed and wanted, which was a sense that the Russian people were not necessarily the same as Soviet leaders. It enabled him to preserve his sense of Soviet leaders as they had been, at least till he met Gorbachev, but the Russian people were different.
What did people in Reagan's cabinet think of her?
It's funny. When she was first brought in 84, I think they seemed to want him to meet Massey because they thought that Reagan was a little bit was too hawkish. As this proceeded, by 3 years later, they're afraid that she is turning him into a dove, and there's a campaign on in 1987 that I showed up in the files. Keep this woman away from Reagan. See what you can do. The people drafted notes telling her, "Sorry, I can't meet you," from Reagan, and he refused to sign them.
Was he listening to her more than to his regular advisors?
When it came to the details of arms control, he was certainly listening to advisors like George Shultz. But when it came to what life was like in the Soviet Union, he seemed to listen to her. Yes.
Now, we've mentioned a number of times the symbolic aspects of the tear down this wall clip, the showmanship. You write that this is one of the points of debate about Reagan. Was it substance that led to the to this change, or was it showmanship?
It was a combination of both. Reagan's own speechwriters wanted him to give a speech that emphasized American values. At the same time, his German specialists wanted him to give a speech which emphasized the differences between West and East Germany and differences between East and West in general in Europe. Meanwhile, his communications people just wanted a good soundbite. They ended up with a huge internal fight over this speech. And the fight was really about two words, Mr. Gorbachev. The State Department did not want those words in there. The National Security Council did not want those words in there.
And why not?
Because they
were... That's what makes it so effective.
Right, they were afraid, wrongly, as it turned out, that this was going to undermine Gorbachev and get him in trouble in Moscow. And Reagan made the decision himself and seemed to think that, you know, Gorbachev could handle it, that it would just roll right off his back.
Well, the whole point of this is that they had a personal relationship, and this personalized the appeal. What was Gorbachev's reaction to the speech?
Gorbachev did not seem to have much reaction. He once in a while blew up at Reagan's rhetoric. He didn't seem to blow up at this one. The real impact was in East Germany. The East German leader, Erich Honecker, was really upset. Why? Because Reagan had not said, Mr. Honecker, tear down this wall. In theory, it was the East German wall. And this was when Reagan said that, it was a reminder that really East Germany lived on at the sufferance of the Soviet Union.
Was there a similar reaction from the other Eastern European leaders in the communist bloc?
Not that I could find. There are a few people in Eastern Europe who said they heard the speech, but it's not clear that how many people really heard it. In the United States, the speech was kind of brushed off. So Henry Kissinger, this guy we've mentioned once or twice before, was on, I think, Good Morning America within a couple hours after the speech saying, you know, the wall will never come. Don't worry, the wall's not going to come down.
Well, Henry Kissinger's always right, so I'm really shocked about that. Honecker was also upset by what was going on in the Soviet Union, wasn't he? Didn't he start censoring East German news coverage of perestroika and glasnost?
He was deeply threatened by everything that was going on in the Soviet Union. I actually interviewed in the course of this book a guy who was the Moscow correspondent for the East German newspaper at the time in 87, 88. And he had the usual journalist complaint. I couldn't get anything in the paper because everything that Gorbachev was doing, they wouldn't let me report. I had to stick to sports.
And Honecker must have recognized that the diplomatic relationship between Reagan and Gorbachev was really a big threat to him.
He was genuinely paranoid that Reagan and Gorbachev, or in general the U.S. and the Soviet Union, were conspiring against him. He said that. I interviewed his successor, Egon Krenz, the guy who was around at the time the wall came down.
Mm. Well, it did hurt Honecker. It did hurt East Germany. I mean, they were absolutely right.
Yeah, there wasn't a conspiracy, but he was absolutely right.
My guest is James Mann. His latest book, The Rebellion of Ronald Reagan, A History of the End of the Cold War, is published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of Gorbachev's big policy changes involved the Warsaw Pact. How did he change it and why?
Well, at about nearly the same time that Reagan gave his speech in Berlin, Gorbachev also visited Berlin. It was for a meeting of the Warsaw Pact, which is the military alliance of the Soviet Union and its Eastern European allies.
It was the answer to NATO.
Exactly. And Gorbachev pushes through in 1987 a new military doctrine. And the military doctrine is that there is no one country or group of countries which can be considered our enemy right now. And that seemed on its face to make sense to Gorbachev. It certainly made sense, but it was a tremendous threat to the leaders of Eastern Europe because the whole basis for their repression at home was that they faced this terrible enemy from the West.
And do you think that Gorbachev made that decision based on his relations with Ronald Reagan?
I think that his evolving relationship with Reagan, with the United States, and with European leaders like Helmut Kohl was the factor.
How much of a factor was American domestic problems? For example, the speech in Berlin followed the Iran-Contra scandal, which broke in late 1986 and was quite damaging to the Reagan presidency. Was this a chance to take people's minds off of what was going on?
For sure. Reagan's, you know, I found in interviews, Reagan's own people, you know, this was Iran-Contra was a tremendous crisis for the Reagan presidency. It seemed on the verge of collapse. Reagan brought in a new group of advisors, and their whole goal, as they phrased it, was not to have Reagan sort of locked inside the White House the way Nixon had been at the time of Watergate. Get him out, get him traveling, and the trip to Berlin was one part of this, and the speech was certainly a part of it.
And many people have talked about how effective Ronald Reagan was at speaking. Did he ever write his own speeches?
He did, not during this period. As president, certainly in the later days of his presidency, you can see once in a while him editing the speeches. He'll mark them up to see where he should pause from sentence to sentence. He didn't write them, but during the late 70s, after he's left serving as governor of California, he travels around the country giving a series of radio speeches, and those are written, you can see them in his own hand, and he was quite effective on his own at putting together very coherent speeches.
And he was effective in making other people's speeches for him sound off the cuff.
Exactly. In fact, you know, it's amazing when I look today at the style of American presidents. In many ways, they tend to borrow, as Gorbachev tended to borrow from Reagan's style. When people say, you know, I have a letter from such and such a city, that was something Reagan had brought in. When you see a State of the Union speech, and you look at a guest up in the audience, that was a Reagan innovation.
And Maureen Dowd has been criticizing Barack Obama for speaking off the cuff while reading from a teleprompter.
Right.
This is something that we also get from Ronald Reagan.
Reagan was as skilled as you could get at reading from a teleprompter. He had it all worked out, how to hold up a paper and look like you're reading from it. But I mean, this was his professional skill.
Now, another problem at that time was the meltdown of the nuclear reactor at Chernobyl. Did that affect the anti-nuclear sentiments of Reagan and Gorbachev?
It affected Gorbachev tremendously because it was a major step in Gorbachev's mistrust of the old Soviet elites, and also a step toward in having Gorbachev try to open up channels of information inside the Soviet Union. So I would say probably not that great an influence on Reagan, but tremendously on Gorbachev.
Another very controversial move in diplomatic efforts with the Soviet Union was the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. What were the terms of that treaty, and why were they so upsetting to conservatives?
They were the treaty outlawed an entire class of missiles, intermediate-range missiles in Europe. And although the treaty passed in 1988 with over 90 votes, when Reagan first introduced it, it had support mostly from liberals and not conservatives. They were worried that in some way this would weaken America's relationship with Europe. Again, things that turned out not to be true. But I have in the book a cartoon that was published at the time that shows Reagan signing this treaty. It says Reagan flanked by the main supporters of the INF treaty, and you look, and behind him are Dick Gebhardt, Jesse Jackson, Michael Dukakis, all the Democratic candidates, all the Republican candidates for president in '88, with the exception of George Bush, were opposed.
How important was the Washington summit in 1987? Was that another turning point, or was that the turning point in the Cold War?
I'm not sure I would call it the turning point, but it was for public images of the Cold War, it was the turning point, because this is the first time you get the Soviet leader meeting Reagan in America's capital. It really dramatizes to an American public that the Cold War has dramatically changed. So symbolically, it's important for policy. They do sign this treaty, which has really already been negotiated. But the real you have Gorbachev getting out of his car and wandering up and down the streets of Washington for a while, shaking hands. You get an entirely different relationship between an American and a Soviet leader.
Including an attempt by an American leader to convert, make a religious conversion of the Soviet leader.
That was at the Moscow summit in '88. And again, this is Reagan going off on his own. This is outside the presence of his advisors like the Secretary of State. No one had really expected this. Reagan had talked to his advisors about maybe he'd talk about freedom of religion in the Soviet Union. And then he takes it a step further and he begins to talk to Gorbachev about being a religious believer. He regrets that his son, Ron Reagan Jr., is an atheist. Gorbachev isn't buying.
People who visited the Soviet Union at this time reported to me that the country was in really bad shape, and many people have said that the Soviet Union would have imploded on its own regardless of what Ronald Reagan did.
Well,
it was just a matter
that's,
of time.
That almost begs the question. It might have imploded on his own, or it could have been a long stalemate, but to have the Soviet Union specifically decide in 1989 under Gorbachev not to intervene as one Eastern European country after another, one regime after another is collapsing. That was not an implosion in the same. You know, it could have been a very dangerous thing, or it could have been a long stalemate. But I think that was really the result of diplomacy, largely under Reagan.
James Mann's book is called The Rebellion of Ronald Reagan, A History of the End of the Cold War. It's published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks very much.